doesn't
sure.
matter. I'll edit it later.
Yeah.
So maybe just say who you are, what you do. This is mostly just so I don't lose the file.
Yeah.
And where we are, actually, which just helps me remember.
Sure. So my name's Ryan Griffiths. I teach in the School of Art and Design at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. I work as an artist, I guess, for lack of a better word, mostly on sort of narrative projects that are research-based and kind of intersect with documentary, although I wouldn't ever say what I do is documentary in any sort of conventional sense.
To help you, like the projects you're doing are around thematics that made you come to the Anthropocene Project or got you invited to it, and in what way, and like why is it something that you're interested in being at?
Yeah.
Simple way of asking.
Yeah, yeah. So for a long time, not even quite sure how to frame the amount of time, but I've been working on projects that have to do with, now what I would frame as intersecting with political ecology as a discourse and as sort of a set of like methods and concerns and that sort of thing. I have worked for a long time through methods of tourism as a way of thinking about structuring stories and narratives, and also as a way to bring those stories and narratives into the places where they are significant or matter or could be understood in those terms. It's not so much the direction that I've been working in the last few years, but that in some ways is kind of what took me into landscape work in a way that was less representational and more about embodied research, embodied encounters, and kind of twisting tourism, or how tourism was a way to disarm people, because who doesn't like to sort of go on a tour, take a walk with somebody, jump in a car with some random interesting person and learn about something. And so that was kind of, I guess, what initially got me into like these kinds of practices. And then really in the last 10, 11, 12 years, this particular group of people, including Brian Holmes and Claire Pentecost, who are here, but also Nick and Sarah and Rosalinda, we've been doing these, basically what this project is, but in a more informal scale. Without sort of resources, it was really just people sort of organizing things through our own networks and trying to learn through organizing these kinds of things for ourselves, and then trying to invite some small public along with us in that way. And then we all of us in that extended group have ways in which then we sort of take the things that we learn together and apply them into work that we are doing in our own places. And so really, I think maybe the work that got me involved in this extended Anthropocene curriculum project was looking at industrial agriculture in the Midwest as a way to understand how that landscape. I'm not from the Midwest, I'm from the Southeast of the US, and not understanding what that landscape was. And so doing in a sort of a many year project that was about understanding that. And that put me into some work with both Brian and Claire in different ways. And so they were already participating in the Anthropocene curriculum, and so Brian sort of pulled me in to that to bring some of the stuff that I was working on.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, the direction that I'd like to pursue is like this notion of tourism, if you don't mind. I know
You
said it's not like a contemporary moment, but
yeah.
This is a fascinating element of this project, which is, of course, the very obvious critique of sort of disaster tourism, Anthropocene porn. People use that term very lightly, but I'm always like, gonzo anthropology, blah, blah, blah. These are all things that have kind of very ambiguous framings. And this is the first time I've ever heard somebody say something quite positive about tourism, actually, in the sense of it being a manipulable medium that you could kind of fuck with in nice ways and get people to think differently. But then the invitation is very straightforward, which is what you said, right? That's the thing that you're, and they get there and you can do whatever you want with them.
Right.
This is an interesting example of something that, like, I think is very easily kind of thrown away and critiqued as just that kind of disengaged, disembodied, nobody helps the actual community. They come here and stare at these things. It's particularly going to be hard in places like New Orleans, right, where there's a lot of real violence and their difficult life styles and ways of life. Because it's just there myself. And so that's interesting that you have thought about that for a while. And so I'm wondering, like, maybe as a slightly internal reflection, like how this feels vis-a-vis your own thinking of like the dynamics of modulation available to something like tourist sort of practices. Mm. Obviously, these people don't think that they're tourists. This is interesting. I'm pointing out the research. Yes. Like, that's a bit weird. But you know what I mean? So what's the feeling you have about this actual activity and, you know, as either self-explained research, self-explained activism, I don't think it's that anyway, self-explained tourism in that spectrum, where does it sit and how does it make you feel?
I mean, there are a lot of the concerns you bring up are concerns that that definitely are present here for me. The tourism, like how I started sort of using tourism initially, like I was giving tours of places that were before not not easily made into spectacles. And so like when I did a long-running series of tours looking at parking lots and their relationship to urban redevelopment over sort of like the 20th century and into the early 21st century. And so that was sort of like one way of shifting that early on for me. In this instance, I think that and with the other work that we've done with this extended group that I was mentioning earlier, all the places we would engage in these sorts of activities where we might be bringing people, but even when it was just us as a small group, always come from a place of long-term engagement. And so there's always somebody, or usually, you know, a few people that are within that group that have a pretty strong sense of responsibility to the place that we are and whoever our sort of immediate interlocutors are in that place. And so even though there are times with, you know, depending on where we are, where I do somewhat understand myself as a tourist, in a, you know, not super conventional way, but still, you know, like here, for example, like this isn't where I'm doing work. Where we are now is not where I'm doing work. But Nick and Sarah have a very long-term and well into the future sense of responsibility and obligation. And it's not a temporary or fleeting engagement. And so a lot of the things that we're doing over, you know, the last couple days are things that we've all done together in a much smaller, intimate group. And that's a really important thing for us that I think allows, I don't know if allows is the right word, but it maybe facilitates thinking about people who don't have that same responsibility to be able to sort of learn from not just whoever the interlocutors are, whether it was Bill Quackenbush yesterday or Randy today or whatever, that there's an understanding of how that learning is happening, that it's not just an expert or it's not just a person who's going to disappear after everybody leaves, but that part of what's happening in that moment of spending time with them and listening to them, that there's an understanding that there are people in that same group learning that are going to be returning, that have been returning, that do have a much more complicated and long-term relationship. And so I think, I guess our hope is that changes something about the dynamic in some way. At least it does in the small intimate group, and maybe this is kind of the largest scale thing that we've done in this size. And so I'm not sure. I mean, I think it'll be interesting talking to you and other people that have sort of been observing these and with a critical eye too, right? To think, well, where is that happening? Where is it not happening? You know what I mean?
I'm constantly trying to pull people away from you as we hold on a second.
Yeah.
Thank you. What's do I need to?
You go on the trail. So we are going to the camp and setting everything
okay.
up.
Okay. Cool.
And we meet you.
So I'll just follow these folks.
For the lecture and for the dinner.
Okay. Cool. So we have 10 more minutes. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So all good points. You know, like, it's funny, I also didn't mean to put you into a justificatory, like, obviously there's nothing in there, because I also forgot that you kind of organized this week, and not forgot, but I wasn't asking a question on that level. It's like, there's so much ambiguity in there, and you said it, so I'm just agreeing with you, that there's, like, because the external interlocutor who's not attached to the space and is temporarily sort of surfacely looking at things often sees things you don't see, and so this is also super interesting as a, but it's really beautiful, I think, the way you said it, is like as a spectrum of people who have different kinds of intimacy with the with the community, and then acknowledging those intimacies, which is funny because it, mostly what I remember thinking was really relieving, maybe this is a personal, even emotional response, because I'm because I am uncomfortable with some of that that spectatorial side of it, is when Bill just kept making jokes about Nick. You know, like the whole tour, he's like, right, Nick? You know, like these kind of funny things. But that's a really big deal, actually.
Yeah.
Because it ties the binds, you know?
Right.
And gives you a sense of, like, okay, so we're invited, you know, we're invited guests.
Yeah.
This guy probably knows sort of who we are.
Yeah.
He's not, you know, totally unaware. Yeah, it's neat. Yeah. I mean, so the just to get out of the kind of meta discourse a little bit. So you've helped organize this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a part of a larger project, which everybody knows is kind of also taking up, not to say this in a bad way, but it's also trying to bind things that are part of an American narrative, part of an American river, part of American mythologies, all this stuff that kind of, you know, also makes us ask questions about how we relate to the Mississippi River, I guess, just to say it, because it's like the title of the project.
Right.
And so I'm curious, like, I guess, I'll ask a broad question, and I'll try to push it further in a particular direction, depending on what you say. But like, the Mississippi is something that you are having to be aware of this week for that reason. The other work you were doing sounds like it was about parking lots and whatever else. And so I guess, like, one of the questions might be, what do we expect from the river as a kind of learning device or a framing? This is probably the best way to say it, because, like, one of the things that's really weird is, like, the Chicago group, for example, were like, yeah, we're attached to the Mississippi. And of course, the Germans are like, no, that's not part of the Mississippi, you know?
Yep.
And so there's definitional aspects. We had long conversations at the Headwaters. I can tell you why this is coming up and where I'm going with it.
Yeah.
Is that Headwaters is a totally problematic definitional device, right? And it's about the contiguous United States. It's got nothing to do with rivers. Like, it's...
Right.
It's where the Headwaters is ridiculous somehow.
Yeah.
And so everyone kept telling us that, and the naturalists at Itasca were like, yeah, I don't know. There's like a plaque.
Right.
Like, I don't care about this. So that's the question, is like, how does the river act for you before and after this project, and what do you expect from it, and how does it?
Yeah. I think that it's good and funny in a way that you bring that up, because I think that's something that our whole, how we thought about the field station and how we started, you know, our first opening event on the river, at a site that has many significances, but largely was sort of picked as a way to identify at the very opening the way we were thinking about the Anthropocene as a colonial Anthropocene, not as a not in this sort of way that flattens the difference about what the Anthropos is in that, and then we move away from it, and so you know, a lot of the places that that our field station sort of deals with, and the life ways within those places is not like along the river as a neatly identified entity or, you know, land feature, but sort of really thinking about watersheds in a very broad sense, and how those places, you know, are not, you know, exactly what you bring up with Deep Time Chicago, and they're saying, well, Chicago is very, very connected to the Mississippi, but, you know, again, if you look at a map, you think, well, not, it's not, but if you look at a map of what the Mississippi watershed is, I mean, what is it? It drains 40% of North America. I mean, that's where the water all eventually makes its way across land and underground there, and so, like, the specific sort of, you know, regions that my part of this field station work with is in central Illinois. So we'll end up in the Quad Cities, which is on the river. But I see that as like a sort of a boundary area or margin in some way of like where really what I've been working on, which is in central Illinois.
Okay, that was a good break. Yeah. We're doing a little interview. Do you need to go move along?
Well, we're going to get started with a walking activity over there, and okay. Stephanie specifically asked if we could lock the truck or van because we're going to be walking up there where we won't be able to see it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can make sure it's locked.
Do you want me to do it right now?
Sure.
Do you have the key?
Yeah, I do. Fishing for it.
We'll be 5 more minutes. Okay. We'll just join in 2 minutes late.
Great.
It's a little tricky in the back. To lock, so like it, you
I'm
turn
have
it.
To turn because the side doors are open too. I'm gonna have to.
Oh
turn.
Yeah, yeah.
Or give this to Meredith.
You turn it to the all the way to the right, and then you turn the key down, and then you and then in order to lock the door, the
you turn
lever.
It and turn it at the same time. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So
that was a good break, okay. But you were saying essentially like. What I really felt also is that, like, you know, I was standing in a former munitions plant today, thinking, like, is it Mississippi? You know, like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Because you do, I mean, I don't care. I'm not, like, curating it. I'm not interested in it being consistent anyway.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating how you get to those spots from the thinking of the river, which is where you were talking about.
Yeah, and so for us, it really is more like the, if you look at the transformations and so, you know, here where we've really been grounding the colonial nature of the Anthropocene and how it could be understood in the places where we are here that are connected to the river. And the river is part of that narrative, but it's not it's not the center of the narrative, right? And so if you're looking at sort of cultural and ecological change in this area, you can't draw a line on either side of the river a certain number of miles or whatever and say, well, this is where you have to look for this. And so that was immediately how we sort of understood it. And so the Mississippi River is part of the story that my particular contribution to the field station deals with. But it's not... It's not the territory where my story happens, if that makes sense.
Totally makes sense, yeah.
I mean, it is and it isn't, right? It's not, like, we're not going to be standing next to it, or you wouldn't be if you were looking at the stuff that what I've been researching has to do with. But so, like, the book that I produced as part of the series that accompanies the field station, and it's funny that you mentioned the headwaters because there's a... In like Champaign County, which is kind of what I used as a starting point, because that's been roughly where a lot of my research has been focused. Not Champaign County per se, but that part of the center of what is called Illinois is also called the Illinois Headwaters, and I sort of use that as a framing device, but a one that's very problematic, because one of the interesting things about that is when you're in Champaign County. What's called the sort of center of the headwaters, finding anything that looks remotely like a river is next to impossible. You can find lots of drainage ditches, and you know, both ones that are artificially created and ones that are just early streams before they turn into anything that even remotely resembles a river. And so the whole idea of water is a really interesting one there, because running water, what you think of as rivers, aren't the primary way that water should be present there. It's, you know, it would have been more present in the form of wetlands and different types of wetlands. That whole area, like most of that part of the Midwest, was intermittent swampland and marshes and ecosystems that now are extremely rare there. And so that's sort of the way that I kind of framed that. Yet, you know, one of the reasons why that landscape has been so transformed does have to do with the way the Mississippi is used essentially as a highway to move all of these bulk commodity crops, especially soy and corn, which dominate that whole landscape.
It's an interesting one because it's like we heard today the summary comments from the lady with the big microphone. I can't remember her name again.
Rosalinda.
Thank
yeah.
You. And she was saying, you know, that this kind of confluence, pardon me, that word gets passed around too much, the coincidence of major cultures and sort of, you know, that framing, which is well understood and
yeah.
Good to point out, to link what we were seeing and what we probably all thought about and read about. And it's like, one of the things that's fascinating about the Headwaters concept even is like, it does that as well. And so like, it's true that like the natural scientists are like, whatever, it's tourist stuff, like I don't care. But at the same time, acknowledging that is actually a form of acknowledging your own culture that maybe needs to be healed. This is the, you know, like the white Western colonial myths that we understand as fallacious or lasting, that the lovely term that Nick used from something else, but which is like a kind of cultural pointing gesture that is so powerful, but then also, you know, when you undo it and then allow it to exist at the same time, you start to really understand your own culture.
And
its relationship to the natural world, And so, like, it's not like anybody wants to do away with Headwaters. It's like, that's important for this particular reason. Because you needed a northern border in the U.S. And you wanted a river to be at the top of it, and you wanted...
But understanding it as a narrative device, that's a way of, you know, it doesn't necessarily explain the place or anything, but it's a way of telling a story. But I think... I guess like what I'm hearing and how you're describing it is that you also have to understand that that's what it's doing, is that it's a way of telling a story that isn't about, you know, accurately reflecting how that place works and the systems involved and the cultures involved, but it does tell, it's a way of telling something about what happens there.
I always think that if you get, and I'm just talking now, but like if you get enough of those visible in your own culture, you're able to, first of all, remake them and make, create new, better mythologies. And then also, like, your ability to actually take, shall we say, Western framings and allow them to have the relationality that we're all, I think, seeking.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, hopefully understanding other kinds of relationalities. Of course, I'm not saying, like, it's, it's not a separatist gesture. But, like, you definitely can get more out of, like, every single cultural meaning in your own culture. It becomes like, you know, like this pan-anthropological sort of sensibility, which is really helpful, actually. So it's not like, you don't want to be like, this doesn't exist. It exists in people's minds. And it exists in culture. But anyway, so now I'm just talking. So the Illinois Headwaters is interesting, and it'll also be interesting vis-a-vis the other, the other site. So I can pick that up later and maybe move it around. Before we start there, I don't want to take too long. You know, one of the things that has been kind of brought up over and over again somehow is colonial, racial, and shall we say ecological or physical, natural, you know, that, whatever you want to call that brand of epistemology. And their intertwining relationships and stuff like that. It is interesting, and by the way, your last comment really resonated with what you guys said at the beginning, of course, which is like, you're really, we're trying to look at this other way of a non-Europeanized version of the Anthropocene, which is actually a big concern of ours as well, as a group that's between the Temporary Art Review and continent European and American. We were like, you know, it's not the same thing to talk about the, I don't know, the trans-historic nature of the subject through Walter Benjamin and, you know, whatever, and then have, like, Flint, Michigan. These are like, this is, and this is the Anthropocene in America somehow. It's like levees and Flint, and it's almost an activist terminology. And European discourses, at least at their origin, were far more interested in Deepak Chattopadhyay, I can't say his name very well, who was writing about, like, this is a new kind of man, and you're like, yeah, that's interesting.
right.
You know, and so this is something, that's a bit of a side point, but I was just curious, like, if you could speak to, it was also interesting that, you know, you acknowledged the fact that you were three white people and, you know, settler people, and then the number of different engagements that you've had, how that felt, like, how did you, you sound like you already know Bill, but, like, negotiating that is one question, and then I guess, like, maybe, well, let's start with describing the nexus in the field station topics, because, for example, you don't hear much about slavery here, but that's still a topic, right, and, racial... maybe even patriarchal, and the kind of, I'm basically trying to say intersectionality, though. Issues that have come up for you both in the actual content of the field station, but then in how you planned it. You see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Practical versus, like, you know, the things that you wanted to pull out.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a lot of aspects of the expanded racial histories that are not just about indigenous displacement and reclamation and settler histories that will come into this and are part of some other aspects of the field station that are in the books and in some other materials that we put together that haven't sort of yet been embodied in that way. And that has been a really important aspect of that, of how we've been thinking about it. And it's, so thinking about like what I've been looking at in you know, the area of Central Illinois, the erasure, for example, of, or, you know, the attempted erasure, which I think thought was a really good clarification that Beth Rose Middleton made in her talk yesterday, of indigenous presence in you know, that the whole area that includes Illinois, but also in Indiana, is pretty intense, and it's intense in how invisible those histories have been made through that, you know, attempted complete erasure that only then surfaces in these moments, like at where I work at the University of Illinois. We have this long-running, really violently offensive mascot that was only sort of disowned, so to speak, by the university because of the NCAA basically saying you could no longer host tournament sports if you keep this. And there's been, you know, fights since at least the 1980s to sort of get rid of that. And even though it's no longer an official image that the university uses, it's still very present by people who are attached to it as an image and as a sort of form of representation. And so that's like one of the places that those histories even come up, right? Which is just so, like, absurd in how violent that is, even if it's mostly a form of symbolic violence, but the real violence that it points to. And some of the other sort of research that I've been involved in more recently and that shows up in the book is looking at the impacts of things like coal ash connected to sort of extractive industries and land use in that area, and largely, at least in rural areas, which is around where I've been doing this research, is largely white working class rural populations fighting that. And so I've been very interested in how histories that are part of their histories, for example, like the coal miner unions and the Wobblies, for example, had a huge presence there when coal mining was a more predominant form of industry in the state. I mean, it's still there, but it's not like it was before the 1940s. And so I've been sort of trying to think through like these narratives that, especially what we've been talking about in the last few days, in that context. And so what does it mean to sort of grapple with and turn a kind of an awareness of settler histories attempted erasure into something that means something in that space and that can be turned into action, because, you know, there are, you know, the people, you know, fighting to get this the Vermilion River, which is on the very close to the border of Indiana and Illinois, the people, you know, fighting to get that dealt with, and they've had some successes there legally, at least. You know, they have some interesting ways of thinking about that space because they have an attachment to that place and thinking about the significance of that river. But so what would it mean to, you know, insert these other discussions about settler history and the removal, forced removal of indigenous populations who are still here? I mean, you know, they may not be present right there in that landscape, but you know, their descendants are in Oklahoma largely, and so what does it mean to, what would it mean to start talking about land in those contexts, when you, for example, the Illinois EPA held a hearing related to this problem of coal ash along the Vermilion River, where there was a coal-burning power plant. What would it mean to introduce that question into that conversation when you start to hear kind of an acknowledgement of the life ways that also exist along that river alongside them as having agency? So like at this hearing, I heard that. So I heard this, like, you know, we can't just engineer this. A river is like a living thing. You can't just direct it. You can't just tell it where it needs to go. It's going to, you know, you may try, but it's going to, you're going to fail. And so, yeah, what would it mean to introduce this, this other more uncomfortable thing into that? So that's kind of where I'm interested in how I can learn from these kinds of encounters and the things that we've been talking about over the last few days, and bringing that into those, or figuring out how to, you know, not that I'm necessarily looking to be the person who says, oh, but you're not thinking about this, right? But thinking about myself as a participant in those conversations, you know, not that I'm the person who needs to educate them, but it's like, oh no, I'm here with you, and I'm learning about these things that I think we should be talking about.
It's a good position, the naive interlocutor, like this other position of a kind of long American tradition from Mark Twain on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's also, he's the one who said a lot of that stuff about the river being unmanageable. I mean, there's a couple of things I'd bring up, but we don't have so much time. Like one of the things that I find fascinating about that is that, of course, this is, and you're the first person in a little while who's brought up labor. Because like there's a whole labor solidarity line that could be really, like, these are all dispossessed peoples, right? You know, so you have like the coal miners, you have the indigenous, you have the blacks, you have, you know, and this is like a really, like, totally unwritten or unnarrativized line of solidarity against capitalism, fundamentally, mm-hmm. like whatever mm-hmm. you want to call that in that particular city is going to be a coal mine. But like, it's true that there's not enough. Yeah, I'm thinking along class lines somehow. I mean, that's an old term, but
yeah,
especially in this world, because we're also uncomfortable with it. But yeah,
it's interesting too. We have as part of the project, we reproduce some of artist Dylan Miner, who's a Métis artist in Michigan, but who also has been very active, and he's part of the Just Seeds printmaking collective, and has been very active in sort of like resurfacing the sort of visual culture and language around labor, especially the IWW and the Wobblies, and like that kind of like radical internationalist union. And so he's like this interesting person that brings those things together as an artist in some pretty direct but sophisticated ways. Yeah,
it's an exciting idea, like a kind of indigenous union aesthetic just created as an imaginary, like not even there's a mythology that doesn't exist yet,
right?
I think we should probably
yeah
but thank you very much. This is super